Hello, this is episode number 32 of Tech Policy Weekly from the Technology Liberation Front for Thursday, October 4th, 2007. I'm your host, Adam Thier of the Progress and Freedom Foundation. This week we're going to dig into the net neutrality debate a little further with Jerry Brito and Jerry Ellick. They're both senior research fellows at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University, and they've just done a comprehensive economic and legal analysis of network neutrality regulation. Jerry Brito, of course, is also a TLF contributor, and I'm also joined this week, as always, by my colleague Tim Lee of the Cato Institute. Jerry Brito, let's start with you. In the paper, you go into some detail about the recent history of regulatory law and regulatory agencies and how they promote regulations. Can you tell us where the FCC and FTC are in this process and whether the policy statements those agencies have released have the force of law?
Well, Adam, the FTC held a workshop last year, and the FTC does this every once in a while whenever there is an issue of great public importance. And they basically hold a workshop, and they invite interested parties to present on the topic. And then they go back and they write a report. And the FTC issued a very lengthy report where it went into detail about whether there was a need for net neutrality regulation. And what they ultimately found was that at this time, they could see no evidence of a market failure or other systemic problem that would call for regulation. Now, the FCC, shortly after the FTC started this process, they issued what is called a notice of inquiry. Now, this isn't regulation or this isn't proposing regulation. This is simply saying, similar to the FTC, this has obviously become an important issue. We need to gather data to decide whether we need to think about regulating or not or what. So they issued a notice of inquiry calling for interested parties to comment. And so what we do in our paper is we look at both of the proceedings and how they went about it, and I can let Jerry Ellick talk a little bit about that. And as far as the force of law, I think what you're referring to is the FCC, when they announced that DSL would be an information service and would be regulated under Title I, or would be sort of looked at under Title I rather than Title II of the Communications Act. At the same time they did that, they issued a policy statement that basically adopted sort of net neutrality principles. Now, what's important to know about that is that policy statements cannot be enforced against any party. And this is a question that the FCC asked in this notice of inquiry directly. They said, can we enforce these principles that we've outlined in our policy statement? And what needs to be known about that is that the policy statement was separate from the rule that they issued regarding DSL, and that policy statements generally just say, look, this is the way we feel things should be, but we haven't regulated yet. And before the FCC can regulate, it needs to basically have a notice and comment proceeding where they take the public's comments into consideration. So the policy statement that the FCC has issued might well become the law one day. It might become a regulation. But before that happens, they need to put it out for public comment.
Okay, before we turn to Jerry Ellick to talk about the economics of this, just briefly, Jerry Brito, tell us, you mentioned in the paper how the FCC and FTC should adopt a more of a straightforward cost-benefit analysis like other executive branch regulatory agencies typically use. Tell us, why is it that that isn't being used, or how could that be used by FCC and FTC?
Well, I guess what I can explain to you is why executive branch agencies, in fact, have to perform this kind of regulatory analysis. And the reason is that unlike independent agencies, and that's an important distinction, is that the FCC and the FTC are what's known as independent agencies. That is, the commission, right, the five members of the commission are appointed by the president, but they can't be fired by the president, unlike, say, the head of a cabinet post or some, say the head of EPA can be fired at will by the president. He serves at the president's pleasure, whereas technically the heads and commissioners of the FTC and FCC can be fired only for cause by the president. So what this means is that they're independent, and they're sort of outside. This is actually sort of an issue that Jerry Ellick and I plan to look at in the future in another paper we're thinking about writing, about how far away are they, how much outside of the jurisdiction of the administration are they. And so basically there is an executive order that traces its lineage back to the Nixon White House that says that independent agencies, sorry, that executive branch agencies have to carry out regulatory review, which a component of regulatory review is cost-benefit analysis. And so what we're saying is, look, this really makes sense. And I can, again, I can let Jerry explain why this makes sense because he could do a much better job than I can. And the FTC and the FCC should sort of look at adopting some of that.
Right. Let's turn to Jerry Ehrlich now. And Jerry, in addition to getting into some of the things that Jerry Brito mentioned, you should also walk us through some of the economics of network neutrality regulation because your paper goes into this in great detail. And just tell us, you know, what does economic theory tell us about the antitrust implications or regulatory implications of markets like the broadband market with the relatively few small number of capital-intensive firms in the market?
Okay, well, let me first pick up where Jerry left off and say something about this framework for regulatory analysis because it really is broader than comparing costs and benefits. There are about a half a dozen different things that executive branch agencies are expected to do. They're supposed to identify what they're trying to accomplish, identify the outcome they're trying to achieve, which may satisfy the economist's definition of a social benefit, or it may not, but they should at least know what they're trying to do. They need to look at evidence of market failure or some other systemic problem that would show them why the unregulated market is failing to achieve whatever it is, whatever outcome they're trying to achieve. They need to try to figure out what unique role can the federal government play in this versus state governments, local, private sector, and so forth. They need to look at alternative approaches, alternative ways of accomplishing whatever it is they're trying to accomplish and figure out which one will actually be more effective. And after they've done those things, then they also need to look at costs and compare costs with the outcomes to try to and make some assessment of which regulatory option is going to be the best way to go once they've actually compared the costs with the outcomes. So that's the basic framework. And one of the things we did is looked at the extent to which the Federal Trade Commission and the Federal Communications Commission are acting in a manner consistent with that framework, even though thus far the White House has not tried to require agencies, independent agencies, to use this framework. And basically what we found, if you read through the FTC's big report on net neutrality that they put out in June, you find that they are acting, the way they did their analysis was pretty consistent with this. They don't break it down to the six steps we talk about necessarily, but it's pretty consistent. The FCC, the way they phrase their notice of inquiry gives us hope that they are going to do some things like figure out whether there's a market failure or some other systemic problem. And actually identify what type of specific outcome or value they're trying to achieve. But we don't know yet what they'll do because they haven't made a final decision.
Now, what about some of the economic issues you get into in the paper about the nature of this market and the unique economics of these sorts of industries?
Well, I think probably the most important point about the economics of this is that in some sense there's nothing new here. Especially when we have new technologies, people like to say, oh, this is completely different and this is very unique and so forth. But a lot of the basic tools of antitrust and economic analysis apply here just fine. So if we're trying to figure out whether the firms that own the network, particularly the last mile of the network, would have incentives to discriminate against content that somebody else provides, for example, or discriminate against applications that somebody else provide. It's pretty much the standard analysis of a firm that may have a strong market position and whether they would have an incentive to disadvantage rivals who may need to use their network to reach the customer. And the bottom line answer that I can give you unequivocally based on economic analysis is, it depends. Now, what that means for the net neutrality debate is that any attempt to prove purely on the basis of economic theory that net neutrality regulation is a good idea or a bad idea is just ludicrous. It depends on the specific facts and circumstances and the specific situation. One of the big bones of contention is there enough competition in the last mile of internet access to discourage the owners of the network, you know, the cable companies, the phone companies, some of the wireless folks. Is there enough competition there to discourage them from doing things that would disadvantage their competitors in ways that harm consumers? And, you know, folks who favor net neutrality regulation will use the term duopoly a lot. Problem is that that by itself doesn't prove anything because, again, a lot of empirical economic research on competition finds that in some cases, two competitors is actually enough to get you pretty much the result you would expect in a competitive market. In other cases, two competitors isn't enough. So again, depends on specific facts and circumstances, not just on spinning out theories and not just on one's ability to throw around rhetoric such as duopoly.
You know, and I think that the FCC was trying to get at that by asking specifically for any evidence of discrimination. And this is something that we did for our paper. We sort of went through and looked at all the comments that were filed in the FCC's proceeding. And, I mean, the FCC said, I mean, they pled, and I can quote from the proceeding. They said, you know, please provide us with, quote, specific verifiable examples with supporting documentation and to and ask Commerce to limit those practices that are technically feasible today. And there were about 10,000 comments that were filed in the FCC proceeding from interested parties. A lot of those were just form letters that were sort of generated by, like the Free Press or FreedomWorks or groups like that. That just, you know, people put type in their email address and send in a comment saying, "I agree with net neutrality. I don't." If you remove all of those, you end up with about 143 comments that were actually, you know, individual comments. Of those, 66 are longer than 2 pages. The rest were not longer than 2 pages. And of those 2 pages or longer comments, only 20 advocated for some type of regulation. And if you even look at those, none offer any sort of empirical evidence the jury's talking about of any actual market failure or any actual form of discrimination.
So, Jerry Ehrlich, you said that one of the claims here is that the broadband networks are sort of new and different, so we need regulation. But isn't one of the arguments that it's actually very old, and the claim is that this should be regulated exactly like the old telecom monopoly, with sort of trying to extend the common carrier model into the broadband era?
Yeah, that is certainly an argument that's out there that, well, telephone was a common carrier and was an important industry, and so this stuff ought to be broadband ought to be regulated the same way as telecom. The problem is we find that if you look at some of the figures and the statistics, you find a big upsurge in the rollout of broadband and a big reduction in the price of broadband in the past few years, precisely when the legal status of broadband became clear and it became clear that broadband was not a common carrier. So it looks like at least you know, the folks who have to build the stuff are a lot more willing to work when they are not subject to common carrier regulations. And yeah, if I were in their shoes, I would probably feel the same way. Now, I think there are two kinds of arguments for common carrier regulation. One is the argument that that the owners of the last mile have some kind of market power, and so we need either common carrier regulation or some other kind of regulation, maybe permanently or maybe temporarily until there's more competition into the market. And that's the kind of claim that you can look at pretty carefully with you know, ordinary economics and antitrust analysis. But there's also kind of a quasi-religious claim that some proponents of net neutrality make, who will say, we don't care if it's a monopoly or not. This is communication, so darn it, it ought to be regulated as a commoner. And the folks who make this argument will correctly cite instances in which things that were not monopolies were nevertheless regulated as common carriers. I'm not sure that that kind of regulation is wise when something is not a monopoly. And, you know, the fact that governments may have done that in the past isn't necessarily an indication it's a good idea for the future.
One of the other arguments you hear that I think is pretty common is sort of a free speech argument that somehow the broadband companies will be in a position to sort of control what content or what services are made available at the other end of the pipe, and that perhaps, you know, Google's preferred video content, say, will be made available, and you know, say Yahoo's won't. Is there any sort of economic logic behind that?
Well, I think this is an issue that is largely separate from the economic analysis, although sometimes they get wadded together in kind of unusual ways. But look, here's how it goes, I think. You know, if your concern is, you know, consumer welfare, in terms of, you know, getting consumers the best possible prices, the best possible, their preferred mix of service and so forth, consumer welfare as defined by economic analysis and the antitrust laws, you know, that is one value that regulation exists to try to promote. It's part of the mix that the Federal Communications Commission is supposed to be taking into account. And it's really it's also really the principal value that the Federal Trade Commission is supposed to be focused on, consumer welfare. Now, the Federal Communications Commission actually has a broader mandate that includes consumer welfare, but also other stuff, virtually anything. And that's where there is room in this debate where some folks argue, hey, wait, regardless of the economics, there are also issues here related to free speech, free flow of information, and folks will toss out the argument that these big companies that own the Internet may try to quash certain types of speech even if it isn't in their financial interest. So it's not an argument that about you know, a conventional market failure because of some sort of a monopolist trying to maximize profits. It's an argument that the folks who own the network will actually give up profit in order to quash points of view that they don't like. Because, you know, arguably, if people are buying Internet access because they want to get access to, you know, a whole range of stuff out on there on the Internet, then, you know, the network owner trying to keep people from getting the stuff that they want to read or watch is going to be kind of self-defeating because it diminishes the value of the Internet to the subscriber. But if the owners of that network are willing to give up some profit in order to pursue some sort of, you know, political objective or whatever, okay, then maybe they would. But the problem with this whole First Amendment debate is that nobody's really rolled out a coherent theory that tells us, first of all, whether or how the owners of the last mile would be willing to sacrifice profit in order to quash somebody else's point of view. There isn't really much systematic theory or much systematic evidence that they do this. It seems like every time something pops up, some piece of news pops up about something that a company did, and these are few or far between, but it seems like whenever something pops up, it's more of an embarrassment than anything else to the network owner, and they, you know, change their policy, and you know, in that sense, maybe sunlight's the best disinfectant.
Well, Jerry, I think that's a good point you made about some of those First Amendment issues, and you referred to it, I think, quite rightly as a, quote, religious issue at times when it comes to net neutrality and First Amendment concerns. But what really blows my mind, and this was witnessed by this incident this week with or last week with Verizon and this instant messaging issue with an anti-abortion group's messaging, is that, you know, in the very rare cases where something like this happens, as you say, the sunlight of disinfectant works quite effectively, and the companies immediately back down, backpedal, apologize, and they look like such fools that, you know, quite frankly, it's hard to know how it could be considered a First Amendment issue. Moreover, the really important point is that the information still gets out. In fact, it probably gets play, and those groups that are blocked in some way probably get more attention if a corporation actually tries to thwart or curb their messages in any fashion. And so this sunlight of disinfectant is really quite important. But the problem is that these groups are using it to sort of exploit some silly mistakes to try to make the case that we need comprehensive net neutrality regulation, or make really outlandish arguments like the New York Times did in an editorial about the Verizon issue, saying that it's, quote, textbook censorship, and equating it with sort of totalitarian Soviet-like censorship, which is just absurd. I mean, if Verizon really did want to do this, they would have the right, in my opinion, to have editorial discretion about what kind of ads or text messages they allow to go over their networks. And they would have the right to do that. That would not be a First Amendment violation because it's a different thing than the government blocking all speech.
The ombudsman for the New York Times recently wrote about the General Petraeus ad that MoveOn.org put out and really scolded the New York Times for running the ad, for allowing MoveOn to run the ad on its pages. And it basically said that it was childish and awful, and that the New York Times should have exercised its discretion and refused an ad that had that sort of message. So, I mean, that's just it's right on point with what you're saying.
Right. And recently, I know Jerry, you were out there at Aspen, our PFF's annual Aspen Summit with me. We had Professor Lawrence Tribe there speaking about First Amendment and new technology issues. And someone in the crowd asked him a question about this First Amendment issue as it pertains to net neutrality. And his response was, quote, this has to do with, quote, the fundamental right of editorial discretion. And this is Lawrence Tribe of Harvard University. Continues, he says, for the government to tell that entity that it cannot exercise that right in a certain way or that it must allow for the projection of a view that it doesn't want to include is a violation of its First Amendment rights. So this is the leading liberal law professor in the United States basically saying that for government to try to tell a carrier, you know, what they can and cannot air is a violation of the First Amendment. And again, I don't want to see corporations censoring any sort of speech or restricting what's said on a broadband network. But as we've just discussed, I just think it's a massive losing strategy for them. In the public eye.
To the extent that it's a systemic violation, that this happens over and over and over and over again, it might be evident that something larger is wrong here. But the point we're making is that we haven't seen any of this evidence. Like you say, there's these isolated incidents, but that's not the same thing as a real systemic problem.
I do think it's important to draw a conceptual distinction. I don't think there should be a legal distinction necessarily, but there is a big difference between, say, Comcast deciding which cable channels they want to run and Comcast deciding which websites I want to visit. I mean, there's a communications provider that's providing something that at least loosely resembles common carriage service doesn't typically engage in any sort of editorial decision about deciding which messages or websites or whatever are worthy of being carried. And now, obviously, that doesn't mean that we need to have the government dictating what policies they're allowed to have. But just conceptually, I think it is a bit of a mistake to analogize Verizon deciding which text messages to allow to the New York Times deciding which op-eds to run.
Verizon was not censoring individual text messages and looking at each one, so it wasn't really more like a common carrier in that sense. It was deciding that NARAL wasn't going to get a short text code, and meaning that it wasn't going to allow NARAL to transmit over its network, which would be analogous to the New York Times on allowing MoveOn.org to communicate over its pages. But I take your point, and the fact that it isn't a systemic problem is sort of just makes the problem moot.
Right.
And I think that just going back to the point that Jerry Ehrlich made at the beginning, I mean, the fact is that, in some of these cases, I agree conceptually there is a difference between, not running an ad versus trying to block a direct message, and then there's a variety of things on the spectrum in between. But regardless of which way you cut it or what kind of activity the carrier is engaged in, the fact is that it's never systemic. It never continues. It's always bad press for these companies. And moreover, the information always gets out through some other avenue. And so, again, the sunshine of public attention is really important here. And I just think it's outlandish that that's what we're going to be regulating on is this notion, especially because, it's not like textbook censorship. And when the government censors, it censors, at least in theory, everything under the sun. If a company does it, there's almost always in our modern media environment another alternative or outlet to turn to find that information. But again, none of these things are systemic, and they're not being engaged in regularly.
Well, I think the argument over censorship also underscores the importance of making sure that we've carefully defined what the problem is and understand what caused it in order to craft a solution, if there is some sort of a government solution necessary. Because net neutrality means a lot of different things to a lot of different people, and the broadest proposal is something like a rule against a network owner blocking or degrading or charging differently based on the content of packets or the identity of the sender or the recipient. Even if there is some type of a First Amendment or censorship issue or some very broad notion of certain things that network owners shouldn't be allowed to prohibit or shouldn't be allowed to block or whatever, I'm not sure that the First Amendment concern necessarily means that that type of very broad network neutrality rule is the right solution.
Another concern that I think is related but distinct is cases where you have other sorts of blocking where the value of the interaction has substantial positive spillovers. So, for example, if you have an entrepreneurial firm like Juiced, which right now is consuming enormous amounts of bandwidth, and one of the benefits of having a few users that are using that kind of bandwidth is it helps develop a new technology that other people will find very useful in the future, but that don't necessarily flow to the current customer, but more to the broader pace of innovation on the internet. Do you think that's something where the broadband providers might have an incentive to limit access to certain services that have positive spillovers for people other than the broadband provider's customer?
Well, I don't know of even any kind of pure, speculative economic theory that says a broadband network owner would want to limit the use or access by somebody who's creating positive benefits for someone other than the network owner. Now, if that user is also creating some costs for the network owner or for other users of the network, then the network owner might want to limit that person's use, as in some of these examples that pop up every now and then where folks get told that their service is going to get cut off because they're using too much bandwidth or using it constantly and doing things that might violate the subscriber agreement. I don't know that the creation of positive external benefits for somebody other than the network owner gives the network owner any incentive to cut off service. It seems to me they would only want to cut off or limit some sort of service if somebody's innovation is also imposing costs on other parties.
Oh, right. Well, that's that's what I mean, is that if you have a service that does have some negative impact. I mean, one of the problems, I think, is that there's a there can be a transaction cost. If you move the internet to a regime where, say, the high bandwidth pipes are only available for people who've paid in advance for them, there can be a substantial transaction cost involved in negotiating access to that pipe that might limit the potential for small entrepreneurial firms to get access in a timely manner. I mean, this is something that you see developers in the cell phone world complain about, where there's this long and bureaucratic process they have to get before they can get either their mobile device or their mobile application approved for use on each of the networks. And I wonder, I mean, one of the benefits that of the internet is that it's very cheap to get your product on the network and have consumers start using it. And I don't think this is probably going to happen, but I do think it's something to be worried about in the abstract if that were to change to a system in which you had to get advanced permission, that even if economic theory in a frictionless sense would say that broadband providers would have an incentive to allow it, the transaction cost of negotiating that permission might still slow the pace of innovation.
Yeah, but Tim, what kind of there's got to be a counterbalance to that at some point. I mean, if that's really something that a carrier is going to engage in, that's going to encounter a lot of consumer resistance. I would hope that we would believe enough in markets to understand that that would hopefully spawn some alternative solutions or plans or technologies. This is when Wayne Cruz and I were writing our book about open access regulation, this was the part of the story that we tried to get across, but nobody seemed to hear, which is that, even the most misguided forms of corporate, mismanagement or bad policies in the world can actually end up having some quite socially beneficial consequences in the long run if they spurn further innovation of other sorts in terms of all new facilities or whatever else. I mean, are you ruling out that that could happen if these carriers play these games or struck bad contracts?
No, I'm not. I'm definitely not saying that that this is going to happen or that you know that there won't be other ways to deal with it. I just do think it's important to. I do think it's a valid point, and this is, I think, something that Tim Wu talks about quite a bit. That I think is valid in the cell phone context. I agree that I don't think that the way the market is evolving that internet carriers are actually likely to try this. But I do think if they did try it and if they succeeded in it could have some negative effects.
Sure. I think this also shows why it's important to understand the fundamental cause of whatever problem you're looking at. It's interesting that this kind of issue and examples have come up mostly in the wireless context. And if you look at least some of the limitations that the wireless carriers impose, those are limitations that they probably would not need to impose if they had access to a lot more spectrum to carry the service. I mean, I tried one of those wireless cards for a while some years ago. I remember looking at the terms of service, and it said something like, by the way, you're not allowed to use this to download video. And I just assumed it was because there was a limited amount of bandwidth available, and they didn't want, you know, one or two people hogging the bandwidth to download movies and slowing down everybody else's traffic in the process. But the fundamental reason is the scarcity of spectrum, which is an artificial scarcity created by federal policy that takes half the spectrum and gives it to the federal agencies, whether they use it or not, and also then makes a lot of the rest very difficult to allocate from, a low-valued use to a high-valued use. So probably the best cure for the problems, at least some of the problems that Tim Wu was talking about, was more spectrum.
Mm-hmm. We'll have to wait and see how it turns out, Tim. But I think that we're going to see the wireless market open up rather than have the internet space close. I'll bet you money that in 10, 20 years we'll see more openness for applications and devices in the wireless space as more spectrum becomes available, as Jerry says.
Yeah, I definitely think that, right? I guess my point was that I'm wary about describing a broadband provider trying to pick and choose which applications to allow as some sort of editorial function. I do think the market's going to end up having a relatively open network, but I think that's a,
You're definitely right. You're definitely right to always make the point that just because we think there should be an open market where different firms can make different decisions about how they're going to treat their data and your customers does not mean that we're endorsing any one way of doing it. Absolutely.
Right.
And when we had Tim Wu on our podcast a few months ago talking about this very issue in the wireless context, he made the point that, whether you believe him or not, he made the argument that he isn't necessarily after federal regulation on this front, although his paper seems to make it pretty clear that he is. But he says what he's really after is it's just about changing attitudes in corporate America about certain types of policies or approaches they use with consumers. And I think that's starting to pay off. I mean, you see announcements almost every week about, a lot of companies changing business models and experimenting with new models. There was an announcement today about Verizon changing its model for when consumers can renew. They don't have to wait till the end of their contract. They can renew and get out of long contracts and get different phones on better terms now than they could in the past. And so these things do change, and that sort of pressure, and Tim, you pointed this out on the blog before, that sort of pressure counts in many different ways and can change corporate behavior and attitudes without coercive government regulation entering the picture. Well, that's going to do it for Tech Policy Weekly this week. I want to thank Jerry Brito, Jerry Ellig, and Tim Lee for joining me. And to read more commentary from the entire Technology Liberation Front gang, please visit us at techliberation.com. If you'd like to leave a comment about something we said here on today's show, you can post a comment on the website for this episode at techliberation.com/podcast. And if you like what you heard, please tell a friend and please write a review of the show on iTunes. And don't forget to dig our podcast. Until next week, I'm Adam Thier. See you then.